You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Big Swing by Andrew Zaleski, with photographs by Rosemary Cromwell. A mix of bros and business class began filing into their seats. I took a breath and swore I smelled the aroma of new money and Olipop prebiotic soda. It occurred to me that the Manning brothers might rejoice in such a paradise, and then I remembered that Eli Manning is a minority owner of the New York Golf Club. President Donald Trump's challenger in the primaries, DeSantis, came in shortly after 6 p.m. to watch warm-ups. He was seen hobnobbing with Woods right on the field. When DJ Khaled walked in, a TGL employee snapped a photo of us as I suppressed a rabid urge to dap him up while smooth-talking another one right in his face. Before Woods took the field of play for the opening tee, I took a look inside the production truck, where Jeff Newbarth, formerly of E-SPAN, Turner Sports, and Callaway Sports, takes command not only of what people in the arena see on the high-def monitors, but also of all the action that viewers see back home. There are 73 different cameras at his disposal, a Skycam like you'd see at an NFL game, multiple cameras embedded on the field itself, a robot cam on wheels, and even a camera that sits directly at the top of the simulator screen. By the President's Day triple header, there were rotating cameras inside the flagsticks on the green. You want to take people where they haven't been, he says. I realized, though, that being at the match itself meant I would miss the dialogue between players, as their live mic conversations are not streamed over loudspeakers during the match. Sure, it's a thrill seeing some of golf's best players live in front of you, but I wouldn't hear what they were saying to one another. Whatever tactics they were discussing on the field, I had to try to infer based on their body language. Shortly after 7 p.m., we break away from Scott Van Pelt, the host of all these TGL broadcasts, and go directly to the picture on the field. Roger Steele, the in-venue MC for the league, stands mid-arena to make the player introductions. The L.A. players walk on to the Tupac classic California Love. Oma and Kisner make their way in, and then in walks Woods. On his way to the playing field, he low-fives Will Lowry, podcast host of Beyond the Fairway, and team ambassador for Jupiter Lynx. You ready for this? Woods calls out. I make my way back into the arena, and it's pure pandemonium. The field of play is awash in red light. Fans are hollering and whistling from their seats. Neon strobes are going crazy, which I had expected once I was told the guy who does TGL's lighting is the former lighting director of the WWE. Finally, Woods walks out to the tee box to lead off the match with a 376-yard par 4. Right at the start, the game's most famous throws a curveball. Woods looks back at his teammates with a small smile on his face and then whips the hammer towel out of his back pocket. Like an NFL coach throwing the red challenge flag, he holds it at arm's length and drops it on the field. Because he threw it before his tee shot, it's enforced automatically. It's not hard to deduce the savvy reasons for chucking a hammer. Maybe you've been hitting great from the tee all night. Maybe you're walking to the green going for birdie. You might as well drop the orange towel, hope the other team accepts, and then putt like your life depended on it in order to win the hole and get the points. Then there's the other reason for deploying the hammer. The instant it hit the arena floor, the crowd cheered almost as loudly as when they first saw Woods. Soon DJ Irie was spinning the favorite song of people who favor obnoxiously large pants. Slices of You Can't Touch This began mixing with the cacophony of the arena environment. Shouts, applause, the sweet, sweet clinking sound that emerges when a titanium driver impacts a golf ball, as well as the looks of disapproval from Charlie Woods whenever Dad misses a putt. By the time the two teams made it onto the green for the first hole, L.A. didn't even bother making Woods putt because they knew the ball was going in. The team conceded the putt instead, although the points didn't go to Jupiter Links. The hole ended in a tie because even if Woods had sunk the putt, both teams would have hit the same number of shots. Tied holes are still a thing. Golf traditionalists breathe easy. As the match progressed, I could tell the vibe I got from inside the arena was undoubtedly different from the at-home viewing experience. Fans mugged for the in-arena cameras, like people do during NBA games, and cheered wildly. "This is sick," seemed to be spectators' unofficial motto of the evening. I heard it dozens of times. And unlike what golf stereotypes might suggest, no one I saw was slowly being lulled into a state of somnolence. Taking a nap would have been hard anyway. During one commercial break, the music kicked up loud, and Steele ran onto the field and got the crowd moving in a wave back and forth to a mashup of techno and Seven Nation Army. At one point, I was taken upstairs to the TGL owner's box and spotted DJ Khaled watching from the front row. To my chagrin, the better angels of my nature intervened, and I refrained from belting out an a cappella version of All I Do Is Win. Still, regardless of all the excitement inside the arena, I did wonder how TV ratings were faring. When I met up with Ohanian in his owner's box, where I politely declined the cake pop hors d'oeuvre offered to me, the match was 8-1 in favor of LAGC, who would end up winning 12-1. I had heard from some TGL folks that viewership dropped off during the opening match of the season, where the final score was 9-2, with people tuning out once the outcome had become a foregone conclusion. Would the same thing happen as the season went on? Or would more people along the way discover the league and start watching? Later, I learned that viewership hovers on average around 610,000. For the 10 matches that aired in primetime on ESPN, viewership eclipsed 800,000. "There is a scenario where no one watches," Ohanian had told me before tonight, "but Tiger Woods alone is worthy of a pilgrimage multiple times a year, and you never bet against Tiger Woods." Even so, it seems, in a losing contest. Because if you tuned out early, you missed one of the most exciting plays of the evening. At the 14th hole, with Los Angeles leading 10-1, it was Kisner's turn to try to sink a putt. His ball had landed in a bunker, and so was placed in one of the three located on the rotating green. He stepped into the sand with his wedge, sized up his shot, and then made contact. The ball flew straight at the pin, bounced off, and launched through the air. Kisner looked up smiling, almost unable to believe what he did. Morikawa fell down from laughing so hard, and even through the ruckus erupting from the arena crowd, which hadn't thinned out at all, I heard Woods giggling uncontrollably and realized that's why I was here. I was getting something I would never see. One of the greatest to ever play, just out with his boys, having a good time, entertaining thousands and thousands of people who will never watch him the way they did tonight. Notes on a Scene. For decades, celebrity interviewer Lawrence Grobel has kept a meticulous diary, excerpts of which are published here for the first time, chronicling his surprising and sometimes maddening experiences with legends Marlon Brando, Dolly Parton, Al Pacino, and more. Opening photos, George C. Scott with his Mastiff, Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, and Dolly Parton on her tour bus. 1977, Dreaming of Brando. November 3rd, first contact with Brando, at least close, got his secretary assistance number, so I called. She said that Marlon would do this and that it should be about the Indians. He was back east, but back next week. She would give him my number and he'd get back to me. I said, or else I'll call him. Had a Brando dream. He was sitting on a couch, his hair in a ponytail. I went over to him and tripped, sprawling on my face. He said nothing. I asked if I could call him Marlon. He said no. I followed him to an elevator, then to a room with people there, walked past them to a smaller, darker room with cushions on the floor. He said nothing. We sat in silence. I felt like the writer who once went to interview William Faulkner and sat in silence with him, finally standing and saying goodbye. I'm obviously nervous about this one. Christmas Day. Marlon is a liar, Patcock said at Bernie Wolfe's house. He was very mean to Wally. He's very destructive. He's often hostile. He still has some of Wally's ashes. I tried to sue him to get them back, but I couldn't find a lawyer to take the case. No one wants to sue Brando. He and I were both jealous over Wally, it's true. We were both possessive of him. Marlon's insecure around intelligent women. He probably wants to see your questions because he's such a liar, he has to prepare for them. If a woman won't go to bed with him, he thinks she's a lesbian. He needs to be stroked. Don't say what a great actor he is. Tell him what a great man he is. We're not talking. We have a mutual dislike for each other. Bernie's wife, Dolores, told this story about Brando at a party soon after she and Bernie were married. Brando kept following me around, getting real close, staring, not saying anything. He made me uncomfortable. Finally, he said, Mrs. Wolfe, you're fascinating to look at, but your nose, what I would like to do to your nose. To which Dolores replied, Mr. Brando, although my nostrils are flared, unless you are very underendowed, there is nothing you could do to my nose that hasn't already been done. Brando backed away, only to nod to her later and indicate hats off. 1978. On the road with Dolly Parton, 10 days on Brando's Island. March 11th. Dolly Parton wore green, a light green silk pantsuit and a dark green shawl, red lips that wore down to natural as she talked, then excused herself 3 times to freshen up, saying she looked tacky when natural. I found her natural look more appealing. She read the Streisand interview and liked it, but didn't know I did it. Her manager, Sandy Gallen, told her that Playboy is the classiest magazine to do an interview, but there are some Bible-toting folks who are her fans, and that concerns her. She'll pose for the cover if the bunny costume can be altered so the crotch can be lowered and she doesn't reveal too much boob. We talked about weight. I said that's why I wore my African fugu. She said that's why she wore the shawl. Calls herself plump. Says she jumps on a mini trampoline for exercise. She talked fast. Addressed her looks for 15 minutes before I ask about them. She said she just figured that's what everybody talks about with her first, so might as well get it over with. When I told her that I saw Streisand for 9 months, she said, we could have a baby if we started now. Then she said she could understand why Barbara didn't mind having me come around. Dolly can be funny, charming, disarming, easy to talk to her, but difficult to interrupt. She sat on a couch with her feet folded under her and spoke for 5 hours about her ma, her pa, her husband, her career, ghost, taking pale baths, growing up mature, writing songs. She talks about being honest, about her talks with God, about her outrageousness, has no trouble talking about anything, though when I ask her how old she was when she lost her virginity, she said if she told me, people would think she was perverted. She rarely goes to movies and has never seen a Mae West film, hardly reads, except positive thinking books. She'll act in movies, but she won't learn to act. She writes as many as 20 songs in a day, 14 of which get recorded. Says she feels she's at the beginning of a 5-year cycle or rise. Aware of her great appeal to the gay crowd, I'm thinking of entering that Dolly Parton look-alike contest on Wednesday, she laughs. Wouldn't it be hysterical if I lost? Next photo, Brando in a candid shot that Lawrence Grobel took during their days together on the actor's island not far north of Tahiti. March 28th, Marlon Brando finally calls and asks, "Do you want to do this in Tahiti?" It's taken longer to get to this point than it did with Streisand, but no matter how long it will take to get to Tahiti, it will be worth it. He's one of the few icons who will last into the next century, like James Joyce, Picasso, Nureyev, FDR, Mao, Lenin. For actors, it's Chaplin, Olivier, and Brando. Love to, I say. Okay, I'm not really interested in talking about acting or anything. I never talk about that. It's meaningless. It's gossip trade. But maybe we can do a separate story about tourism in Tahiti. They need some kind of help. But I can't give short shrift to what's happening with the American Indians. And to some extent, we could talk about the environment, which is certainly cheek by jowl with the Indian issue. So maybe those two things could dovetail. No problem, I say. How old are you, Larry? 31. Okay, I want to say that I'm disturbed by the extended runaround you've been getting from me. It's just been one crazy thing after another. But it's an obligation not only to you, but to Hugh Hefner, who came up with $50,000 to get Russell Means out of jail. He did it on trust, and I'm grateful. I certainly feel that I owe him a debt. I'm looking forward to this. Okay, then, if anything comes up, call me, will you? I'll be in touch, and I'll tell you what to bring and all that stuff. We hang up, and I'm elated. Going to Brando's Island. Perfect place away from the rest of the world to do an interview. Next photos, Grobel and a mournful Pacino confer at the actor's home in Sneddon's Landing, New York, which was sometimes referred to as Hollywood on the Hudson. Brando's letter. And Parton leads a procession through London's airport after landing. May 6th. At the Howard Johnson's in Winchester, Virginia, to join Dolly Parton's bus tour. She greets me by phone from her room. I've got lots of stories, she says. Here's the plan. After the sound check for the Apple Blossom Festival concert, you and me will talk on the bus until I get tired, or you do, then we'll call it quits for a few hours. After the show, if we feel like it, we can talk some more, and all day tomorrow. We'll be honest with each other. When we want to take a break, we'll just say so. And now you're on the bus. May 7th. As we cross Virginia, Dolly comments on the scenery and how it looks like where she grew up. I realize that for 4 hours I haven't looked out. I've just focused on her face. I've asked her so many questions, she says. Is this a magazine assignment, or are you planning to write a 2-volume book? I tell her just a few more days, and then maybe a few hours in Oakland when she appears with the Beach Boys and Linda Ronstadt, and then again before the interview was scheduled for an update. Okay, she says, finding the gum she had stuck under the sink and sticking it back in her mouth. Whatever you need. She talks about becoming a female Elvis Presley, how her vision of herself is reaching millions of people. At the motel, we talk for 6 hours, from 11 p.m. until 5 a.m., no taping, just exchanging stories from God to ghost. May 25th. Marlon wants me to write him a letter outlining the specific areas we will discuss, and then he will have a lawyer draw up an agreement for me to sign. I took a deep breath and said no. If Brando doesn't like my questions, he can always ask me to leave his island. May 27th. Sent Brando a mailgram saying the interview should be free-ranging and not narrow in one topic. He got it and said, okay, come as planned on June 9th. Nothing to sign. June 8th. Called Brando's personal assistant, Alice Marchak, and asked if there's anything I might bring Marlon. She suggested a nonfiction book, perhaps Colby's CIA memoir or something on electronics, but she warned me if I gave him a book, he might read it instead of talking to me. June 25th. Took 3 days before Marlon agreed to let me turn on the tape recorder. I'd ask, feel like working? He'd answer, no, not really. So we sat and stared at the bay and talked off the record. He'd say, it's all very elemental here. The sea, the sky, the crabs, the wind. If the mermaids don't sing for me here, they never will. I joked, yeah, this is the life, Marl, just sitting here in silence in the elemental wonder of it all. When I mentioned acting, he'd say, acting bores me. And I said, I know, but if I was talking to Heifetz, I'd be asking him about music. And if I was with Mickey Mantle, I'd talk to him about baseball. And he'd respond, if you were with Willie Moe Douglas, would you ask him what Marilyn Monroe thought of him? And on it went. We ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. Went night sailing, walked on the beach, sat on the pier under a strong moon, played chess until 1 a.m., and somehow managed to tape 15 hours of conversation that I'll transcribe myself because he spoke very softly. Not as psychological as Streisand or as playful as Parton, but it's Brando. Witty, funny, serious, and memorable. Took 68 pages of notes that I'll add to this journal. 1979. Brando's disappointed. Al Pacino wants the guy who did Brando, the sterilization of Native American women. January 24th, got a 3-page letter from Marlon about our interview. Disappointment has waned and smoldering resentment has lapsed. Great opening sentence. He complained about how it was edited to include what he felt was trivial conversation to the detriment of all he had to say about the Indians. But then he wrote, I might add that you did indeed make me sound more intelligent from the way I remembered speaking to you. Thank you for that. He asked if I could present him with all the raw material, because there were things that I said that I would like to use at some other time in some other article. And then he wrote, I must tell you that people have said many kind things about the article, and I have received letters praising the article. I am grateful to you for having helped me to appear more organized and articulate than I would have been had you printed it verbatim. As I put it all together now, our experience seemed to have been a very useful one. Belated thanks to you. He went on to criticize the editors and added a PPS. F the press. Unless you know them and trust them and know them not to be at the mercy of the editors, it's the same old story. June 19th. Al Pacino read my Brando interview and said he'd consent to do one if the guy who did Brando did it. So it looks like I'll be going back to New York. Next photos, Parton and her 9-to-5 co-stars Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin at the movie's premiere in New York City in 1980. Scott at the premiere of Uncle Vanya in L.A. in 1976. July 17th. Wrote to Brando to let him know that Playboy's given me a researcher to investigate the issue of Indian sterilizations, an issue he wanted me to write about. Told him about the tribe in Claremore, Oklahoma, where supposedly 85% of the women have been sterilized. Wanted his help to reach Dr. Connie Pinkerton Urey, an Indian activist who has a lot of information about this, and also Jimmy Durham at the UN. I went to see Durham when I was in New York, but he never showed up. July 20th. This morning, Dr. Connie Pinkerton Urey called. She'd been to Wounded Knee, shot at, bullet grazed her hairline, addressed congressional hearings. She told me about a tribe in Oklahoma where she thinks 100% of the women were sterilized. But they fear for their lives, and it's hard to get them to talk about this because they don't want their husbands to know. White women will make decisions about their bodies on their own, but Indian women like to talk with their men, and since most have been sterilized, without their own knowledge, they're ashamed. It's hard to document. Women don't trust the system. What can you promise them that hasn't already, in some way, been broken? Indians have no faith in the justice system. Two suits about sterilization were brought in Oklahoma and California, and the one in Oklahoma took only 20 minutes for the jury to find the doctor not guilty. July 25th, Al Pacino wants me to see a screening of And Justice for All in Levittown on Saturday night and meet with him at his 68th Street apartment on Sunday afternoon. The studio will send a limo. Spent all day at the Academy Library yesterday, wrote 300 questions. August 16th. It's been a few weeks since I wrote in this journal because of all the time I spent with Pacino in New York. He was nervous when we met, but we got along like brothers. Got 37 hours on tape. Since I returned, he's been calling, concerned that he said too much. Can't write much now because I'm on a deadline. Have to get this done in 4 days, and I've only finished indexing the 2,000 pages of transcript. August 18th. Pacino called, said he hopes that this part of our relationship is over and that we can now enter a new phase, that of friends. I did 31 pages of the interview yesterday, 14 the day before, and hope to get another 25 pages done today. He said he moved his bed to the window. I've been living here for 6 years with the bed in the wrong place. I've also moved the building onto Fifth Avenue from Madison, he joked. Then he said, even if this is the greatest interview in the world, if I had a choice, I'd rather it not be printed. August 20th, finished Pacino, 4 12-hour days, 108 pages. I think it's good. August 23rd, Al was so worried about what he might have said that he went to the Playboy office and spent 4 hours with my editor, Barry, who let him read it. When he got home, Al called to say how amazed and pleased he was. That human thing came out. Nobody knows this about me. I'm a very simple kind of person. It's not sensational. I saw our relationship. It's not glib. It's just these two crazy guys talking. You're not stroking me. It's not like movie star talk. It doesn't make me sound like a jerk or like the smartest person in the world, which is okay. Next photographs, Patty Hearst and her daughter with Grovel at a hotel in San Carlos, California, as they ease into the interviewing process. And Pacino comes upon the legendarily tenacious paparazzo Ron Galella and is not pleased to see him. September 20th, the phone half rings and I pick it up, thinking it's my wife, Hiromi. Hi, the voice says, I knew it was you. I say, how'd you know by the ring, Dolly says. I recover, and she talks about her recent tour to Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Japan, and Hawaii. Australians, she says, are like southern people, real down home. She says she's down to 112 pounds and feels good about that. Says she'll be in L.A. in November for the 9 to 5 movie. You're so busy, I say. The only way I'll get to see you is write about you. Maybe we can get married, she says. Of all the stars I've met, she's the most naturally flirtatious. We talk about writing and how frustrating it is to start something and have to stop. She doesn't even try to write if she knows she can't finish. Listen, she says, when I get an apartment out there, you'll come by for dinner. September 22nd. Ran into Colin Higgins, who is writing the script for 9 to 5. He wanted to thank me for a scene he's using that came from my interview with Dolly, about how she had a gun in her bag and threatened some drunk guy to leave her alone or she'd turn him from a rooster into a hen. November 13th, Lawrence Terman, a producer at Universal, sent over a script for Pacino, saying he's a difficult person to reach and if I can get him interested, I could be an assistant producer. His cover letter, misspelling my last name, mentioned how terrific my interview with Al was. This town is so deep in desperation and bullshit. November 19th, Iran hostages began to be released today, but only women and blacks. Spoke with Pacino for 45 minutes. He's doing Brecht's in the jungle of cities, but it's not going well because the director isn't flexible. Dino De Laurentiis asked him to direct something, not act. Your interview is going to get me work. He bought a house along the Hudson, but doesn't know when he'll go there. Said he switched from eating blueberries to nuts and raisins. It concerned that Billy Friedkin has been fooling around with cruising, making a lot of changes in the editing. He didn't sound happy about it. November 22nd. Terrorists have captured the Grand Mosque in Saudi Arabia. In Pakistan, the U.S. Embassy has been burned down and two Americans killed. 1980. Preparing for Hitchcock, Dolly Parton forgot her gun. George C. Scott, tough guy, in the jacuzzi with Patty Hearst, Elliot Gould wants to live forever. January 3rd. Going to Paramount to screen some Hitchcock films. Spoke to Ernest Lehman, who wrote North by Northwest and Family Plot. He just attended a luncheon honoring Sir Alfred's knighthood. I asked how Hitchcock was. He's 80, weighs a lot, doesn't move well. Your interview will be difficult. He's created an image with the press by being shrewd with his aphorisms and cleverness. If you get him on a good day, he can surprise you. Talking about sex, he's remarkably candid. He claims to be celibate for the past 60 years. He tells four of the filthiest jokes you've ever heard right in front of secretaries. January 7th, Al got in last night, said he was waiting to hear from Billy Friedkin to see how cruising is coming along. He called at 1:45, wanting me to meet him for lunch at the Imperial Gardens on Sunset at 2:30. When I got there, Al was there, leaning against a post near the front door. The restaurant was closed on Mondays. How long you been waiting? I asked. Since I called, he said. 40 minutes. He let his driver go eat lunch. I'm sorry, I said. It's okay. I watched cars, and then I realized they were watching me. We got in my car and drove to the Pear Garden, but they were closing, so we went to the Aware Inn, also closed. The Old World was open, so we went there and asked for a quiet table. Al was in an agitated state. He said when he got to the Todd A.O. studio in Hollywood, where Friedkin was editing Cruising, Friedkin refused to let him see the rough cut. It's not ready, the director said. I'm mixing the sound. You'll have to wait a month. A knot began to form in Pacino's shoulder. I have no power, he said to me. There's nothing I can do. I just wanted to see what he's doing. Is that so bad? I mean, I'm in it, too. It's my life up there. I can only help it. He knows it's a controversial subject, and he wants to make sure it's not going to be anti-gay. If it is, I'm not taking my percentage. I mean that. I wondered if this might be his first X-rated film. It should be double X, with one X burned into Friedkin's forehead, he said. January 9th. Al came to our house and stayed for 3.5 hours. We took a walk around the canyon. When three barking dogs came running toward us, Al froze. Then we walked on. He talked about the nature of relationships, of his being selfish, and that he wants to do films that have dignity, films like what Spencer Tracy did. He turned down Starting Over and now regrets not having read Kramer vs. Kramer. He wants to look deeply into love. Bobby Deerfield aimed at that, he said, but it missed. It was too subtle. He wants to show another more normal side of himself on screen. January 10th. Spoke with Elliot Gould, who said, when I asked him what he was up to, I'm adapting the Tara for a subterranean life. Typical Elliot response. Talking to him is taking a mental coaster ride. He's the opposite of Al or any of the other stars I know. He talks fast, jumps all over, has opinions, and is always concerned with survival and moving on. His is a complex story. from his childhood ads for Fox's You Bet to his marriage to Barbara and his second marriage to Jenny, his three kids, working with Ingmar Bergman, appearing on the cover of Time, smoking dope during interviews, his close relationship with Groucho, and his continuing self-analysis. "When I mentioned I was preparing for Hitchcock," he said, "I'm supposed to do his next movie, me and Lee Volman. I had dinner with him. He said, 'You're an Indian, and you're also a clown. He can hardly stand. I said we'd wheel him around. He said he's great from the waist up. You know, he's never eaten a tomato or an egg. He said, it's all music. Pictures are like playing the piano. Actors are notes. Each is an element.'" January 14th. Hitchcock ill, not up to being interviewed, indefinitely postponed, leaving me with all my preparation up Schitt's Creek. February 6th. Herb Steinberg at Universal calls Ree Hitchcock. "I'm afraid it's a scratch. Can I go off the record? He's been in the hospital for 5 days. He just got out. We don't know if he'll recover." I say I'll call back in a few weeks, just to check, but it's off. F. February 12th. Yesterday, went to 20th Century Fox, Stage 6, to watch Colin Higgins direct Dolly, Lily Tomlin, and Jane Fonda in 9 to 5. When Dolly saw me, she waved me over. We embraced in front of the production and lighting crew. She looked like a yellow darling in her yellow Lanaterna sweater. Dolly will do for sweaters what Brando did for T-shirts. She said she's going to do The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas with Burt Reynolds next, and she's got another album. She's bored waiting around the set and feels she can't read or write or compose between takes, though she did manage to write the theme song for the movie the other day. "Do I look like a secretary?" she asked. "No," I said, "you don't, but maybe a very expensive secretary." She said that she had never been on a movie set before, and it was so much fun because I'm a real fast learner. I don't need to be told but once, and I got it. She spoke about how she, Lily Tomlin, and Jane Fonda work. Lily works slow, but that's okay. She's responsible for a lot of the comedy. Jane works quick because she knows what she's doing. I work quick because they figure it wouldn't make no difference. I'll do it the same anyway. February 14th. Picked up Dolly at Fox, and we drove to Santa Monica and Malibu with her saying, "You can't drive for shit, just like me." We took a walk along the beach, but not on the sand, because she had on high heels and didn't want to take them off. While we walked, a large dude was sitting on a bench, and when he saw us, he said something loud about her appearance. Dolly gripped my arm and said, "Shit," and I left my gun and my purse in your car. After we ate lunch, we drove to Bel Air 5 hours later, and she started telling me how close she felt to me and how special I was and that my eyes misted whenever I talked about sensitive stuff. I asked her to sing the theme for 9 to 5 that she had composed in 2 days. She began to click her long red nails against each other to simulate the rhythm of a typewriter. I think it's going to become the national anthem for secretaries. April 11th. Al called. He was so disappointed with cruising, he met with his lawyer to give his money to charity. I found out that they screwed me on the contract. It was not a good deal. I may never see any money. He said he won't go to the Oscars, even though he was nominated, his 5th, for And Justice for All. I don't like to go and sit there for 3 hours when I know I'm going to lose. May 3rd. Met with George C. Scott at his Beverly Hills house on Roxbury. White-bearded, wearing glasses, a well-worn beige sweater with sleeves pushed up past his elbows. B&W herringbone slacks and brown boots. He is tall, his teeth are chain-smoked yellow, and his lower teeth are crooked. We sat outside at a redwood table. He brought his own tape recorder. I turned on my 2, and for the next 5 hours, I never looked at my questions. Later, when I went over them at home, I saw that I asked him 165 of my 710 prepared questions, which was quite a bit, as I usually only cover a dozen or so prepared questions in the first session. But with Scott, there was no room for small talk. His answers were often brief, and that should change as he gets more comfortable doing this. I wore my African fugu, and it occurred to me that Scott was still a Marine at heart. He believes we should have invaded Iran within the first 72 hours of the hostage-taking, that we should have let the army decimate North Vietnam, that Reagan will be president, and that if Nixon was president, we wouldn't be in the mess we have in Iran. He mixed a bowl of Bloody Marys and drank two glasses, then some tequila, and a few beers. When we broke, I said about our conversation, "It wasn't so bad, was it?" "No, it wasn't," he said. "It gets worse tomorrow," I said. "I know," he said. May 4th. We only had 2 hours, from 10 a.m. to noon, but we got a lot done. This interview was not a game to him, as it was to Brando, nor is it a coronation, as Streisand took it, or a coming out, as it was for Pacino. Scott is all business. He doesn't like feeling captive, which is how he feels doing this interview. He said he'll have a car pick me up when I go to see him next week in Greenwich, Connecticut. Not sure I want that. I don't like feeling captive either. May 16th, back from the East Coast, where I spent 3 days with Scott and a few days with Pacino and with my family. Drove myself to Scott's 16-acre estate with a long driveway, a stone bridge, and a gated entrance. He has a modern stable of horses and 2 large dogs, a mastiff and a shepherd. Got 4 to 6 hours on tape each day. He drank and smoked throughout. He was very touchy about Ava Gardner, whom he fell for and physically abused. I don't talk about Ava, but though I disagree with most of his views, I got him to talk about them. The only time he asked me to turn off the tape recorder was when I asked him about guns. Yes, he sleeps with a .357 Magnum and has 2 loaded shotguns in the closet. And yes, his wife Trish has her own gun. And the reason? Some years ago, Scott and his then-wife Colleen Dewhurst were living in a 1-bedroom, 2-story apartment in Greenwich Village. They were asleep. Scott was naked, Colleen nudged close to him, and he thought she was having a bad dream. So he put out his hand to pat her back, and she slipped under his face and whispered, "Someone's in the room." Scott said he nearly had a heart attack. He could hear a guy breathing right over them and could smell the alcohol in his breath. Scott leaped up and shouted, and the guy took off. Scott grabbed the guy's hair on his way down the steps and then chased him outside, where he stood stark naked in the street. He suspected it was another tenant in the building. The next day, Scott saw the guy he suspected and said, "What was that all about last night?" The guy said, "What?" And Scott took off his glasses and knocked the guy down, then jumped on him. I was going to kill him. I was going to pound his head in the sidewalk. But the guy talked him out of it, and Scott got up, turned his back, and the guy kicked him in the spine. It really hurt, and now Scott was running from the guy. It was like the Keystone Cops. After that, Scott went out and bought some guns and has had them ever since. The transcript is more than 200 pages. May 31st, went to see Dolly at the Bel Air Hotel. We recorded for an hour for a Playgirl interview, ate lunch, and then talked for another hour. I asked her if she ever thought of putting out a Dolly's Greatest Hits album. She laughed and said there were 2 already. Dolly Parton's Greatest Hits. Then she said, "You know, you have more material than anyone else, and I'm glad it's you, because if anything happens to me, I know you'll know what to do with it." When I got home, there was a phone message from Christy Hefner. Could I join her, Patty Hearst, and her husband for lunch at the mansion tomorrow? Finally, it's happening. A journalist's dream, going head-to-head with one of the biggest stories of our time. A story that captured the world's imagination. My Japanese mother-in-law doesn't know about Barbara Streisand or Dolly Parton, but she knows who Patty Hearst is. Yes, indeed, I'll be there. June 1st, when I walked into the breakfast room at the mansion, Christy waved and told me to pop into the kitchen to let them know what I wanted to eat. Patty and husband Bernie were there. I shook their hands and, after placing my order, sat down next to Christy. They had been talking about rape and rape prevention. Bernie, a San Francisco policeman for 10 years, said he goes on TV to speak about the subject. As he spoke, Patty muttered, "Charming. I thought it was a strange topic of conversation, considering what happened to Patty 6 years ago when she was 19 and kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army, SLA, becoming a fugitive for 19 months. She was sentenced to 7 years in prison for bank robbery and the felonious use of firearms that President Carter commuted after she served 3 years. Sitting across from her, she didn't seem as diminutive as I thought from all the photos and TV coverage of her. She is small and fragile looking, with a bony face, thin hair, deep brown eyes, and the nostrils of the rich. Long, thin, and a bit pinched. Yet there is steel in her eyes, and when she talked, I sensed her determination and strength. She's a young woman who grew up a Hearst. She understood money and how the rich play, by yachting, hunting, traveling, and eating well. While we ate our seafood salads, Bernie and Patty talked of their recent hunting trips. At San Simeon, they hunt boar, deer, and turkey. On their turkey shoot, Bernie related proudly how he blew apart a turkey with his shotgun. Then Patty was given the double shotgun, and she shot two turkeys with one blast of sprayed pellets, then hit another. Three and two shots, she said, and they thought I wouldn't get any. 1981, Dolly vetoes Charlie Manson. January 16th, Playboy asked if I would consider doing Charlie Manson. I was surprised, because I remember that they once said that under no circumstances would they interview Manson. But apparently, now that he might be available, they've changed their mind. But my editor has reservations about me doing it because he feels it could be dangerous since I just had a kid and live in the Hollywood Hills where Manson's people did their dirty deeds. He asked me to think about it over the weekend. Charlie Manson, the personification of evil. I remember being in India with my friend Glenn after leaving the Peace Corps in Ghana and how the people shied away from him because his hair was long, he had a beard, and he resembled Manson. The whole world knows about Manson. I've always thought that given a choice to interview anyone in this century, I'd lean toward Hitler. Manson, while no Hitler, is our Satan. A chance to wrestle with evil, to contest the black forces. But then, playing with my daughter Maya, thinking of all the effing crazy still out there, what if they found out I was seeing Charlie? Would I get calls? Threats? Visits? Once my address was found, how vulnerable would we be? Is it worth the risk? I decided to make some calls to ask friends for their opinions. I called Larry Schiller, who has been around these kinds of stories for a long time. He dealt with Gary Gilmore and with Manson and some of his family. You've got to do it, Schiller said. It's a chance of a lifetime. How can you say no? Then he added that Manson would do to me what he did to him before he met him. Set off a bomb in front of my house. But that's all. It was just a scare message. I still get letters from Squeaky Fromm. But other than that, nothing. Because when I met him, I was straight with him. That's what you've got to be. You can't F around with him. You have to tell him up front that there will be things in the interview that he won't like, and that you're going to pursue all avenues. He'll respect you for it. But if you do anything behind his back, if you misquote him or change his words, then you're in for trouble. Harlan Ellison was pretty strong that I should not do it. So is my friend Noah Ben Shea, who kept saying, pass, pass, pass. Look what happened to Ron Hughes, his attorney who disappeared. Don't get tied up with black energy. He's the scum of the earth. Why F with your head? Every time his probation comes up, you'll be reading the newspapers, especially if you make him look bad. And if you make him look good, he doesn't deserve that. And if you hold back out of fear, then you're corrupting your integrity. Control your own destiny. Then out of the blue, Dolly Parton called. Hi, guys, she said. How interesting that you called, I said. I'm in the process of making a decision. I told her about Manson, and she quickly and forcefully set me straight. "I think he'd steal your soul," she said. "I can't even look at a picture of him. If you did it, I know I wouldn't want to have much to do with you. It's not the kind of thing you could take pride in doing. And you wouldn't make a difference. The attention would be on him, not on you. I know it's an amazing story, but being the way we are, you and me, with a wonderful, pure force in you, just 1 minute with him could destroy all that we can be about. That's how spirits work. You'd have to be brave to deal with him, and I know you are, but it's something you don't tempt God with. I'd be afraid it would get to me. With us talking about working together, just when we're about to do it, this devil has come up between us. The connection we're about to have won't come to be if this comes to be. You and me would be more like in a battle, and I'd be looking at you differently, because it would change you, and you may not even know that. The darkness is something not to get involved with. As good as you are, it would be a mistake. I'm talking now as a friend, and I want you to think about it. Have you talked with Manson yet? Good thing I hadn't, or she would have probably hung up on me. But Dolly pretty much made my decision for me. No candy if I play with the devil. These diary entries have been condensed and edited for clarity. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.